Hallo, liebe Hörerinnen und Hörer einer weiteren Folge der Interviews for Future, dem Podcast der Leipziger Scientists for Future, heute auf Englisch. Hello, dear listeners of Leipzig Scientists for Future Podcast Interviews for Future. Today I have here with me Gianluca Grimalda. Hi, Gianluca.
Hi, Dominica. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, you are a bit famous for your straight decisions that you didn't go to use a plane for coming back from a research. But first that we have a picture. What is your field of researching? Who are you? What's your engagement? What are you doing?
Yes, I would say I'm a social scientist interested in social cohesion and cooperation. So social cohesion, is that the ability of a group of people to help each other, to express solidarity with each other. And more precisely, I want to study how social cohesion evolves, changes when there are threats, like in particular climate change. So over time, I have decided more and more to focus my field of research on how people adapt and how people are prepared to cooperate when there is the possibility of collective risks. And in particular, this is one of the projects that I carried out last year when I was in Papua New Guinea. So we wanted, in a way, to simulate situations in which groups can experience losses, can lose money because of bad negative events occurring. And I wanted to study the propensity to mitigate, so to speak, to cooperate with other people to reduce the risk of collective losses, or adapt, which in a way is just to protect yourself but not do anything for the other individuals, or just do nothing. So this is the type of things that I wanted to observe.
This research you did that went a bit longer as planned, and then you were ordered back by your university, the Kiel Institute of Weltwirtschaft.
Yes, so I must say that the Institute has always been positive with me. So they always accepted my willingness to slow travel. So throughout the 10 years that I have been employed at the Institute, they always counted the days of slow travel as days of work. And so I think I was really grateful, and I felt, I don't want to say lucky, because I think that somehow that should be acknowledged to researchers who want to travel in this way. But I really had no problem before. And I must say that in the past, it had already occurred that I was late after a field work, because you can imagine that there are a lot of things that can go wrong. And when in the past I had been late, nothing happened. So I didn't think it was a major problem this time. And I mean, it is true that my fieldwork got delayed by a lot of time, 7 weeks. So it's really a lot. But there were a lot of really negative things that happened to me, like robberies that were actually carried out, or just threatened volcano eruptions. And I felt my duty was really to finish my research. And I thought my institute would understand that the duty of a researcher is, first of all, to complete the research. And I communicated all these delays to my head of department, and there seemed to be nothing major about that. But then all of a sudden, they told me, okay, now we are going to have a video call in 5 days. And then the video call happened, and they told me, you have to come back in 5 days, otherwise we fire you. And I found that unacceptable, because there was no reason for me to be in Kiel in 5 days, no reason at all. They never gave any reason why I should have to be there in person in 5 days. It was an ultimatum, so there was no attempt to understand what had gone wrong. So the president of the institute, throughout these 6 months in which I was in the field, had never asked me how things were going. So my only channel was my head of department. And so I felt that I was, in a way, not treated fairly. And so I said that I don't want to comply with this order which in my view it's completely meaningless at a time of climate breakdown, either close to happen or already happening. And so since I found the request as a completely unreasonable, I decided to stick with my principles. I thought that if I had accepted their order, I would have really reneged on my moral principles. And so I prefer to keep my integrity rather than giving to these type of requests.
You're not only researching, you're engaging yourself in such actions as example, scientist rebellion, so civil disobedience. Can it be that this was a way to discipline you, that they maybe came to the point to be afraid that you go much far and...
Of course, I have no evidence for that. Some people made that point. For instance, Julia Steinberger, IPCC author and also involved in civil disobedience, made the point that this was a kind of retribution, a kind of punishment for my past involvement with civil disobedience. And I can also say that in 2022, after some civil disobedience actions that I carried out, the then directors of IFW had threatened me with the dismissal. So they told me that civil disobedience is intolerable for a center like the Kiel Institute for the World Economy. And so they confirmed that they would have tried to terminate my contract if I had continued with the civil disobedience, which I did. Then nothing happened after my ongoing actions of civil disobedience. Then I went to fieldwork, and then, 8 months after the fieldwork, this happened.
You told that it before wasn't a problem, though. So you didn't had to fight for going by ship, maybe in this example, not by plane, and then it changed. On the other hand, you did civil disobedience. What is something to do a inner step? So, how are you as a person? Are you this kind of let's say like to go in action, or is it more coming out of the pressure of climate disaster? What's your motivation to go so far?
Well, I decided to do one step further precisely after I realized in 2022 at the COP26 in Glasgow that we were far behind the necessary commitments to keep us in climate safety. Of course, I don't need to remind your audience about what the outcomes and I would say the failure of COP26 was. But, COP26 was crucial because it was the year in which countries had to present the nationally determined contribution. In principle, then the next would have come after 5 years. So it was really crucial. And it was at that point that I got into touch with Extinction Rebellion and Scientist Rebellion. And gradually, I decided that doing one further step was the right thing for me to do. And of course, at the time, I didn't have any evidence to say this is actually leading to social change, to the type of change that we want. I suppose I did it just out of desperation, because I felt that our voice as a scientist is pretty much ignored, or at least the change that we observe at these meetings like the COP is really happens at a very, very slow pace. I did some back of the envelope calculation. So if you compute what has been done in terms of emission reduction in comparison to what should be done for the goal of net zero by 2050, we have done more or less only 17% of what should be done. So in a way, I don't want to say that the COP has been completely ineffective. There is this 17% of emissions that have decreased, but of course the remaining 83% is missing. So I thought I needed to raise my voice, and I think civil disobedience is noble. Noble is something that really heroes of the history of social change and of peace have done. Of course, Muhammad Gandhi and Martin Luther King. And so I entered into the philosophical principles of civil disobedience, and I appreciated most, I think the one thing that I appreciate the most is the willingness to obtain change through dialogue and cooperation with the population. So behind civil disobedience, there is the idea that you want to appeal to the community. You want to call on people on the rightness of your cause, but you don't want to do anything alone. You really want to have the support of the people. And so for me, this aspect of communication is at the basis of a civil disobedience. And this is what I really like. So some people depict us as anti-democratic, but I would say that it's really the respect for democracy that pushes people towards civil disobedience. So before, when I did my slow travel, it was mainly something that I did for myself to be, let's say, at peace with my morality. You know, I said, I want to do research at a low carbon. So I traveled to Tokyo with the Trans-Siberian. I traveled to Colombia on a cargo ship. So throughout these 10 years, I did 260 days of slow travel during my research trips. But I didn't think of really making these actions as something really big because, as I said, it was mainly for myself. But then after 2022, I really realized that it was important for individual actions to become part of a movement. That's why I joined Scientist Rebellion, and that's why also my individual action, I tried to make it popular on social media. Because I really wanted to, you know, raise awareness and persuade the people. Not persuade, I don't want to say persuade, but really once again launch an alarm as strongly as possible.
To look at in the way of communication, public communication, breaking rules, that's an essence of civil disobedience. Has breaking rules an effect you can measure? You can tell us that's doing this and that if you do so?
So that's a very good question. I think something that we have to remember is that we don't have just one public. There are at least six different types of public, according, for instance, to the Yale Center for Climate Communication. So, and these six publics go from the alarmed to the concerned, to the mildly concerned, to the indifferent, to the skeptics, to those who basically are in denial. And I think in principle, different types of actions would be good for different types of people. Personally, I have the utmost respect for the kind of actions that L'Esta Generación does. And within our movements, we have what we call the right to action. So every group is entitled to act and to receive the support from the other groups as long as the action is nonviolent. So we really hold the principle of nonviolence as our common denominator. I comply with this principle, but personally, what I tried to do with my actions is to, let's say, go to another stage, or maybe to talk to a different type of public than the public that l'ex generazione wants to talk with. Because I think at the point in which we are now, pretty much I don't want to say everyone, but the vast majority of the people have realized that the temperatures are rising and that climate disasters are occurring. This is also what comes up from a recently conducted survey. It is forthcoming on an economics journal. They run a large-scale survey in, I think, 18 countries around the world, some of them high-income, some of them middle-income countries. And I think, on average, 85% of the people answer that they realize that the temperatures are rising, and they associate these with the sea level rise, with the increased heat waves, etc. So I don't think we need to alarm any more people on the fact that the climate is changing. I think what we need to do more, and I think that's also difficult, is to make the link between burning fossil fuels, deforestation, and the raising temperature. So even according to this survey, this is something that it's still not clear. So for instance, if you ask people, do you think that just reducing by half the emissions of greenhouse gases will be enough to stop climate change? The majority of the people say yes, reducing by is enough. And we know this is not enough. We have to completely stop using fossil fuels. If you ask if you ask people, do you think that what you are doing is enough? They answer yes. And then you ask, what is the thing that the most important thing that you do to reduce emissions? And they say, recycling plastic. Recycling plastic has a 0.01 effect on temperatures increase. So there is still a lot that people underestimate, and therefore in the type of a transformational change that we need. And so that's why I think that I would say it's more efficient to really target the actors that are really, really responsible for what is happening, which means the industry. So that's why personally...
Go in between for a moment. When you say that people underestimate the effect of greenhouse gas and what's happening, the disaster of climate change, do you think they underestimate, or do you think they want to underestimate because we are clear it's really hard to face this horror?
Yes, again, it's probably both. For part of the public, it's, let's say, yeah, what we call cognitive dissonance in social psychology, in social and cognitive psychology. So when there is a bad truth, you prefer to remove it. Denial of a problem is one of the most effective ways that your mind can use to solve a problem. You just rule it out. And of course, the reason of the success of Donald Trump is at least in part due to the fact that he says very blatantly that climate change is a hoax, and the people feel liberated because they remove one problem. So unfortunately, that is true for at least one part of the population. And honestly, I don't know. Some people say, okay, we should not care about the denialists. So according to the Yale Climate Communication Center, denialists, so these are really radical people, and also according to this survey, they are no more than between 10 and 15% of the population. So they are not many, according to the surveys. I think there are many more because we know that surveys tend to undersample people who, so to speak, hunker down, people who are antisocial, they are relatively marginalized. So, but let's say they are more, they are 20%. I don't think they are the majority. In the US, probably they are even more, but no more than 40%. So I don't think they are the majority of the population.
Let's say 20%, for example.
Yeah. So some people say, okay, let's forget about the nihilists. Let's just try to persuade the people who are, so to speak, in the middle. And I think they have a point. Actually, there are some people who also say that it's good to speak anyway with the denialists, and in a way, you have to speak using their own values and your own system. So, I think we can do something even with that, but of course, it takes more time, and there could be reasons for failure. But let's say it would be strategic, really, to try to involve what Johan Rockström would call the silent majority, really, to try to get on our side, so to speak, the people who are undecided, the people who will decide to cooperate only if they see others to cooperate. You know, that's really a fundamental message of what I study in social psychology. So we tend to divide the population in more or less three groups: the selfish. The selfish will never cooperate unless they are forced to cooperate. The altruists, the pure altruists, will always cooperate regardless of what others do. And then there are the conditional reciprocators. So the conditional cooperators are the people who are available to cooperate if they see enough other people who are willing to cooperate. And they are the majority. They are more than half of the population. So, in a way, the people who are involved with the social movements are the pure altruists. They would cooperate anyway. So the real challenge is to attract let's say, the silent majority, so to speak, the conditional cooperators. So at the moment, clearly, we have not managed to do so. And I don't want to say that radical actions like blocking roads is ineffective. I think we need, for sure, we need both this type of action, but we need more of, let's say, moderate actions, moderate people really trying to speak with the silent majority of the
What
population.
is in this point about fun? Because I would really say people research it. There's a funny video in YouTube, a pe person blocking a street, but he's not doing it with his behavior as Letzte Generation does it. He's dressed like a big snail and robbing very slowly. This video has much over 40 million clicks, and it's you can show it closely every person. They say in the first moment that's a very important moment. If the first inner thing is a yes, and you can use it with those effects, as we see in USA elections with ways of show and so on. We don't see this in climate action. It's always so bad mooded, I would say.
Yes, I think in part it was what I was saying before, but I would say what I saw with the Extinction Rebellion is that a lot of actions by Extinction Rebellion are really, in a way, they have this fun component, and they try to be inclusive and participative. The problem is that they don't get much media attention, so that is what again, social scientists call the activist's dilemma. So, if you do something that is not radical, the chances are high that the media will not talk about you. And if you do something that is really radical, then the media will talk about you, but in a bad way. So, in a way, you really have to try to find a balance between doing something that is radical enough to gather media attention, but it's not so extreme that people think that you are immoral. And the problem is that, of course, a lot of media reports are biased. And I can tell you out of my own experience. So after I concluded my actions, a journalist would call me on the phone. The first thing that the journalist would ask is how many people got arrested. So in a way, the journalists really want to have want to see blood in order to have something to report. So I think it's difficult to find the right message, the optimal message. And I don't think, as I said before, that there is one type of a tactic, one type of message that is good for all the people. So probably some types of radical action are good for the people who are already concerned in order to make them even more concerned, but they run the risk of alienating the silent majority. For the silent majority, you need other types of actions, but then the problem is that these type of actions are not really portrayed so much in the media. Personally, I think that, you know, we need to insist with what we do. In the end, we need to do what we feel also it's like for us to do, because there is also a fun element with respect to ourselves. You know, when I was active with the Greenpeace, I always remember a friend of mine from Greenpeace told me, you know, we have to do something that is fun for us, because if we feel that we must do it, in the end, we'll lose, you know, enthusiasm, because it has to be structurally something that we enjoy doing it.
If you have an action that's a bit too radical, if it's maybe possible to use different roles so that you have a little group that does this action that, as you told, is clearly going in the media, but clearly telling the bosses it's too radical. But then comes the non-radical people and fill this room of communication with climate topics, serious and so on. So that you only have this radical hand smashing on the plate, but this hand is not the talking role later on.
Yeah. Yes. You know, there is also some research now that is available not a lot, but there is some research that also tries to investigate what are the tactics and what are the targets that are most effective for the general population. So, you know, they run these surveys. They did it in Germany. They did it in the US. And what we see is that these actions have some effects. Maybe each action, radical or non-radical, so each action has some effect in moving the level of concern by the general population, but in general, very little. But if you ask what is the most effective action, that's a boycott. What is the least effective action is to throw soup in a museum.
Okay.
You know, that's clear. That if you want, I can give you the reference. And then they tell you what is the most effective target. The CEO of a multinational energy company. What is the least effective target? A museum who has already complied with zero net zero, let's say. So, I personally, I think we should use a variety of tactics, and to some extent, I agree with you that only use radical tactics at this point of time runs the risk of alienating large parts of the population. And so personally, I think that it's important to have less radical action, even at the cost of not going on, you know, the national TV every day, but being sure that your message is clear, that you make the link between the fossil energy industry and the increasing temperature, deforestation and increasing temperature. And of course, it takes more time, but I know that we are desperate with the time, but I really think that the fact that in the last European elections, the Green Party lost so much in Germany and France has partly to do with the fact that, in a way, only the radical actions have been portrayed as the main ones by the environmental movement. And I think that has alienated many people.
So you have a disbalance. The people think all the greens are radical and the non-radical are not visible in a way.
Yes, but Of course, I mean, part of the blame, I don't want to blame l'ex generazione at all. Part of the blame really also has to do with the media and the fact that I would say the industry is very capable of manipulating the discourse and manipulating the message in order to make it look like as the environmental movement was only made up of radical voices. Instead, there are many more voices, and of course, there is also Fridays for Future. There are also other voices that have do receive media attention, but yeah, probably not at the scale that radical movements are achieving.
So there are many, many, and much every day, much more people in climate science, climate scene, and so on. They go, I would say, depressed between that they don't see a sense in maybe blowing up pipelines, and don't even seeing a sense in making the next demonstration on Friday noon. And on the same time, one catastrophe and bad message hunts the next one. Trump election as an example. What would you say those people, what to do?
Yes, so I think, of course, that's a reasonable reaction. Yeah, I often quote the Italian politician and also political scientist Antonio Gramsci when he talked about the pessimism of the intellect and the optimism of the will. So if you analyze the situation critically. Of course, there aren't many reasons for optimism, but I think personally, what I've tried to do in a way is to change the narrative that I say to myself. So I think so far many environmental movements have used the narrative of let's save the planet. So we have this big cliff. So we have the 1.5 or 2 degrees limit. Johan Rockström talks about the planetary boundaries. So we have to fight to avoid that we trespass, we transgress the planetary boundaries. And what happens after we transgress the planetary boundaries? Well, very bad things will happen, perhaps even a human extinction or collapse of our civilization, and so on and so forth. So I think this type of narrative is very effective to attract people in the movement because there is a clear danger and you can mobilize a lot of people. Actually, in the end, we didn't mobilize so many people, but for sure, since Extinction Rebellion and Fridays for Future started, we have millions of people now who would take to the street. So in a way, we have managed to mobilize many, many people. But if you know very well, if you analyze this narrative from the scientific point of view, it's questionable that there is a threshold, a global tipping point over which the catastrophe will automatically happen. And even if there was a global tipping point, this would be uncertain. So this is much more difficult to communicate because people are not really, the general public are not really, I would say, trained to deal with the probabilities, with uncertainty. So, you know, it is as if they go to the doctor and they want to hear, am I ill or am I not ill? They don't want to hear you are ill with a 20% probability. But I think as a scientist, we should try as much as possible to convey this more objective reality in which we don't know whether there is a global tipping point. It's, I would say, possible that there isn't just one tipping point, but many tipping points associated with many ecosystems. So rather than having one big cliff over which we are basically done up, we have many more decay, many more many falls
It's
in
more
our
like steps than a cliff, not like stairs.
Exactly. So we know that, for instance, the coral reef has gone more or less with high probability. The next ecosystems that could go could be the Greenland and the West Antarctica ice sheets, etc. And then the Amazon forest, up to some time ago, they said that the tipping point would be very far away. Instead, now they say that it could be actually very, very close. So unfortunately, we have uncertainty, and personally, I don't think that the narrative of committing to stay below 1.5 is at this point the one we should use. I think we should talk about natural disasters. So we should really say, we should count the number of hurricanes that happen in the US, the number of floodings that happen in Europe, and say to the people, look, this is happening with much higher frequency than in the past, with the much higher intensity. We need to protect ourselves. And I think that should be our metric rather than temperature rise that in the end, most of the people will think, okay, one degree is nothing. It's not really something that captures people's imagination. So I think this is what we should do. And personally, I am convinced, or let's say I want to be convinced, that as the type of disasters that we have seen in Valencia, the type of floodings that we have seen also in Germany, becomes more frequent, and the people will be even financially affected, I think it is inevitable that there will be a much stronger demand for climate action than what is the case now. So, in a way, what has been my hope has been, I mean, that's in a way tragic, but what I was confident to some extent was that this type of gradual climate change would happen much faster than the component of a catastrophic climate change. And I'm still convinced that as people realize that really disasters are happening more and more frequently, then they will demand more climate action. So I think as a environmental movement, we should capture these moments of realization by the general population, and we should not give up. So we should not get discouraged. You know, the suffragette started in 1830, and they got what they wanted in 1918. So of course we are desperate for change, but you know, sometimes the change takes a lot of time. The civil rights movement didn't happen in it took I mean decades of a fight. So as many people who are listening to this broadcast know very well, this is not a sprint, it's a marathon, unfortunately. But we have to be prepared to also to accept that we lose some ecosystems. So I think it's inevitable that we are going to experience losses. We are already experiencing losses. So this idea of save the planet, this narrative of save the planet, in a way, it's already gone. It's already unrealistic because we have already lost a lot of ecosystems, a lot of stability in our planet. And so in a way, we have to kind of leave behind the idea that we have the planet in the same way as we had it during the Holocene.
Yeah, but we can save something. It's very nice and very feelable that you're still on and still motivated, but you're focusing the problems clearly. So what's your personal next kind of step in engagement? Do you have some plans?
Yes. I have some research commitments, and so I plan to go back to Papua New Guinea again in January, and I'm committed again to go there without catching a plane. So it will take quite a long time. I'm still unemployed, so I go there as a freelance researcher. Fortunately, I have found the funding at least for the travel and for my subsistence there. But I don't have a salary, but I'm very happy to do that because I love research, and I love studying how people in these societies that are so vulnerable, so exposed to climate change, adapted to climate change. You know, I go to this small island called Bougainville, in which pretty much every people living on the coast already had to relocate inland because of sea level rise. People experience not yet famine, but for sure they have food shortages because the yield of their crops is decreasing because of temperatures rising and droughts becoming longer. So I really think that I have a commitment to this population, and I want to go back because even they have realized that temperatures are rising, but they don't know why. They don't know why. And so I really like, you know, I gave at least 50 presentations in all the communities I visited, in which I tried to explain why the temperatures are rising, who are the responsible, and what we can do. So I really want to go back. But when I come back here in Europe, and in a way I'm already started, I would really like to launch a new campaign, hoping that I have enough support and the collaboration from scientists, and this new campaign would call for a global climate strike by academics, climate scientists, but also non-climate scientists. And the general message would be that in a situation in which we keep on writing reports, but our reports are pretty much ignored by the political and the economic leaders,
and the media.
Sorry?
And the media.
And the media, yes. We need to do one more step. And I think this step in relation with what I was saying before, so I would like this step to be such that it does not alienate people, it does not scare people away. So strike is something that people, workers have been doing for a lot of time. Also with the scientist rebellion, we tried to call for already a climate strike. And I think this is a type of action that would attract public support, or at least I hope. And so the general message would be to say, okay, we really stop with our work of writing reports. We go to the street and we try to share with the general public what we know. So I've already done it with the Scientist Rebellion, this type of, we call it teach in, but I think it's better to call them share in. And of course, as a scientist for future, you know very well what I mean. But I would really like it, you know, to send a message that we want to get to the street, or maybe we could do an open day at the university in which we invite people from the public inside and inside our universities. And we try once more with, of course, a very accessible language that you know better than me how to use. We try to get alert the general population. But I think with the general strike, hopefully, we would have a larger participation than what is normally the case for civil disobedience. I think that is something that is very, very important as well. You know, also this comes up in empirical research. So the one thing that matters the most for, well, policymakers in one study run in Belgium is the number of people taking part in a demonstration. So that's also another thing, you know, so far many of our actions have been fragmented, and that's good. But for instance, what Extinction Rebellion and also Greenpeace, other groups have done in the Netherlands last year was very effective, but there was a mass mobilization that actually involved the civil disobedience, because in the end they blocked a road and they managed to have tangible results. Although, yeah, maybe now the government, the Dutch government, has somehow backtracked. But I think that was an example. I think that was an example, I think, of a very large demonstration that also had a very good press, precisely because there were many, many people. And this is what I hope, to really gather a lot of support. in order to make this action really successful.
So all the scientists listening into this podcast, we will hear from you. I have two last short questions, a good one and a bad one. What we should start with?
Yes, maybe, you know, I don't think we need a new start. I think it's okay. We need to carry on with what we are doing. You know, sometimes I think we are maybe too, I mean, on the one, I would say too desperate for change, but on the other hand, I would say too impatient. As I said before, the suffragette obtained what they wanted after nearly 90 years of demonstrations. So I would say just be patient, and yeah, maybe I would say try to spend more time communicating and make sure that the link is always there between the real responsible, who are the industry, the fossil fuel industry, also the food industry that is responsible for deforestation. And honestly, I mean, if I want to say something that is a little bit dystopian, but honestly, I am scared also looking at what is happening right now in the US. I am scared of getting too aggressive against our governments. I really feel that there is a danger in the possible civilization collapse that might happen, that we observe governments failing and not having the capacity to carry out even the little good things that they have done so far. And I think the industry would love a situation in which there are no international organization, there are no national governments, and they can get on with a little bit during colonial time, in which they have their own army, they defended their own interests, like the, you know, East Indian Company. I think that's a future that, of course, I want to hope that we'll never realize, but I don't think we can discard this type of future. And so my advice would be maybe to be really, I don't want to, let's say, be aggressive against the industry, and don't forget that the state has been a vehicle to bring about reduced inequality, reduced poverty throughout the 20th century. You know, sometimes we are, I think, too dismissive on the success of the welfare state. So we lived in a much more unequal society, in society with societies with much less, I would say, social progress in 100 years ago than now. So sometimes I feel that we should really choose our target very carefully. And that, of course, there are many responsibilities, there are many, you know, connections, bad connections between the political system and the economic system. But I would say that the target should really be the industry rather than the government. So that would be my advice.
So good research, but strange action in doing. Funnily, you misunderstood my last question, but you answered it very well. So I will say, let the people let this sink. If you have something in the end you want to bring out, but I think it was your last word, as you wish.
I think I've been fairly comprehensive so far, but I would say, yeah, maybe the last word again, yeah, don't give up, and yeah, just be patient. So we know, again, also based on research in the social sciences, that yeah, there are tipping points, not only in climate systems but also in social systems. And maybe we are very, very close to a tipping point, but for the very nature of the tipping point, you know, in a way, the change of the system will happen very, very quickly. And then maybe we are so close to it and we don't know, but maybe that is the case. I mean, we saw with the COVID that our society changed completely, more or less overnight. And the reason was that everybody perceived that there was a big, big threat. So I think, if you like, my last word could be as follows. So I think there has been a lot of debate in the environmental movements and also in the social sciences in terms of should we give a message of hope or a message of fear? And so far, I would say the dominant view has been to say, let's give people hope. So let's try not to be so, you know, scary. Otherwise, people will just go into a panic situation. They will freeze and they will not act. And I mean, to some extent, there are reasons to understand why people say so. But on the other hand, I think that, this strategy clearly has not worked. Personally, I think that fear is a stronger motivator than hope. And I think in the US, we have had the clear example that a message of fear by Donald Trump was way more effective than a message of hope by Kamala Harris. So what matters in my view is not so much this dichotomy between fear and hope, but really giving people possibilities to act. And so a message of fear, which I think is not really a message of fear, but it's just a message of realism. When we talk about all the planetary boundaries that we have transgressed, all the ecosystems that have that are close to collapse, or that have already collapsed with a very high probability, natural disasters that are happening. So I think we need to make people aware that these things will happen more and more frequently if we carry on with the business as usual. But we also need to say that there are a lot of possibility to act. And the one thing that I always recommend to people who ask me, what should I do, is my answer is join a social movement, because if you remain an individual, you can do a lot of good things, but you will remain isolated. By joining a social movement, your action will be massively amplified, and therefore that's the way to go. I don't want to tell you have to choose this movement or this movement or another, maybe even a political party, but just become socially active.
Yeah, Gianluca, then thank you very much for this interview.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Mm-hmm.